You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a lot of families are dealing with high costs and uncertainty when it comes to long-term senior care. Our guest tells us what's driving those costs. First, Labor Day in the United States is a way to honor workers and to mark the American labor movement and its history. Unions played a big role in many of the gains of American workers, including five-day work weeks and the minimum wage. The Economic Policy Institute just released a new report called How Today's Unions Help Working People. Central Times executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson talked to the president of the Economic Policy Institute, Larry Mischel, last week about the report.
How exactly would you say unions fit into today's U.S. economy?
Well, unions are a weaker force than they used to be. They represent about 11% of all the workforce. They are a much more diverse collection of people than they're known to be or thought to be, with about 46% being women, about 36% being people of color, and they represent workers in all sorts of industries, manufacturing and construction, as people think, but also in health and transportation, moving into digital media and other matters. A lot of white-collar workers, about 40% of union members these days have a bachelor's degree or more.
You said that it's declined. What was kind of the golden age of unions, would you say?
Well, in the 1950s, unions represented about 30-35% of all the workers. They've especially lost a presence in the private sector. Public sector workers grew more unionized over this period, and private sector workers less so. But what really matters, in my view, is that this erosion of collective bargaining and union, the reason why there's a lot of wage inequality while men's wages in the middle has fallen behind those at the top, the single biggest reason is the erosion of collective bargaining.
And remind us what collective bargaining is exactly.
Well, collective bargaining is when people get together and they form a union and they have rights to, and they do, negotiate with their employer over wages, hours, and working conditions. And that's a right given to them by law, the National Labor Relations Act passed in the 1930s. If you're in the private sector, in the public sector, the laws are dependent upon what your state has decided.
And who benefits the most from that element of collective bargaining, would you say?
Well, what I was saying was that the loss of collective bargaining has fallen most heavily on men. And not just men that are in unions or used to be in unions, but when unions had a strong presence in an occupation or an industry, the wages of non-union employers and the benefits the non-union employers offered most of the time mimicked what was in the unionized agreements by the unionized employers, because they didn't want their workers to leave them and go to the union sector, or they were afraid that the union organizer would show up and organize them. So the biggest single loss of wages because from the erosion of unions is actually of the non-union workers, who no longer get a boost because employers are less fearful of becoming unionized.
So you write a lot about the benefits that being in a union brings to the workers that that union represents, but you also say that the unions work on protecting workers and things like collective bargaining also benefit non-union workers. Can you explain that for us?
Well, that, yes. So when you have collective bargaining has a strong presence in an occupation or an industry, it not only helps the workers in that industry, but it also helps boost the wages and benefits that are received by the non-union workers, because their employers, the employers who remain non-union, mimic the standards set in the union sector. They don't want their workers leaving them to go to a unionized firm, or they may be fearful that if they pay too little, their workers will choose to join a union, and they might want to avoid that. So the biggest single loss of wages in the economy to non-union workers is actually from the loss of collective bargaining, because they lose that. That's been especially true for men, who are blue-collar or don't have a college degree.
We're talking with Larry Michel. He's president of the Economic Policy Institute, and we're discussing their new report detailing the role that unions play in the U.S. economy. And Larry, in the report, you also write that unions strengthen democracy by giving workers a voice in policy debates. How does that work, and can you give us an example of that?
Well, you know, we know that people participate more in the electoral process when they have a union that informs them of what's going on. They're much more likely to vote. We know that unions are one of the few organizations that weigh in on fundamental matters that, that affect people's, working conditions. Are you going to be able to get unemployment compensation? Why are you going to get workers' compensation? Is there going to be safety and health regulations? All those types of matters that affect everybody's working conditions really rely very heavily on the power of workers and through their unions talking to policymakers. And you can see where in states where unions are not very strong, you know, they don't have very good systems. Texas doesn't even have a workers' compensation system. Florida doesn't even have a Department of Employment or Labor that seeks to protect workers from wage theft and other things. So I don't think we will ever have a robust democracy unless we have strong unions that allow people who don't have a lot of money to really weigh in on the policy choices in front of politicians.
So policy debates are often part of elections, are part of legislation, and there have been critiques that just like super PACs and other outside third-party sources of money, that unions can have a big influence on elections and more often than not are supporting Democratic candidates over Republican candidates. How would you respond to that?
Well, when there's money that unions put into the political process to politicians, it's not actually from the regular dues. It's from additional voluntary contributions that people make into the PACs. And, unions do weigh in on matters. Many do support Republicans. Some unions do and some don't. But people should see, who is it that is representing the interest of workers when it comes to the bread and butter issues. Who's protecting OSHA, occupational safety and health? Who's protecting the unemployment comp system, the worker comp system? Who's fighting for a higher minimum wage? Who wants to get people paid leave, paid sick leave, all these other matters? You'll find that, the expansion of labor protections, the elimination of things like child labor, the people who brought you the weekend are the unions, says a T-shirt I own. These are all things that only came about by agitation by workers organized through their unions.
In 2011 here in Wisconsin, we saw Wisconsin's Act 10 law passed, an effort to curb unions and those especially of public sector employees, including a measure to limit collective bargaining. Is that a trend that you see across the country at this point?
Well, Wisconsin followed some attacks in New Jersey by Chris Christie, but Wisconsin did start a bit of a trend. It later followed up with a so-called right-to-work law, which undercuts unions in the private sector, which Governor Walker said he wasn't going to attack when he did Act 10, but he later did turn on the private sector unions. It did create a wave of some similar anti-union legislation. It was defeated in Ohio in a referendum. Some of the right-to-work laws were passed in Indiana and Michigan, and I think most recently, Kentucky. And Missouri is fighting over that right now. So, it did start a trend, and, in my view, not a very happy trend.
And as we wrap up, Larry, the report concludes that there's a need to rebuild collective bargaining and union representation. How optimistic are you that that's in the near future?
Well, what I do know is that if you ask workers in polls, would they want to choose collective bargaining, and do they believe a majority of their peers at work would want to choose collective bargaining tomorrow if they could vote on that, that you get around half the workers say that they would. And, you know, of course, that's far more than the people who have collective bargaining. So there's a vast unmet demand for people who want to choose collective bargaining as a way to resolve their problems. And I think they ought to be given that. And I think ultimately we're not going to be able to achieve shared prosperity that includes a robust middle class unless we do get collective bargaining. So I think the country will eventually turn to restoring collective bargaining. The exact form that takes, I think, is uncertain at this point. But, you know, the political odds aren't good in 2017 to see that legislation, or 2018. But we'll see what happens in 2021.
Well, Larry, thanks so much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
That was Larry Michel, president of the Economic Policy Institute. He talked to Central Times executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson last week about a new report from the EPI about unions in the United States. Coming up, whether you're thinking of your own needs later in life or those of your parents, the cost of long-term care can be cause for worry. We'll talk to an economist about why care is so expensive and what would need to change in order to fix it. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.